Okay, so this morning I'm going to talk about form and emptiness. I'm going to talk about the relative and the absolute. I'm going to talk about the particular and the universal. So, for many, many years, I have been chanting every morning, form is emptiness, emptiness is form, morning after morning, week after week, year after year. And for years, I didn't know what it was all about, and Suzuki certainly didn't help me on that. Katagiri Roshi really tried to explain it, but I didn't exactly get it. But if you use the terms universal and particular, it's a little easier to get a sense of what's going on. So I'm going to attempt to give a sense of what's going on. So many of you already know the Heisenberg principle, right? Some of you, raise your hand if you know the Heisenberg principle. A half of you know that. Oh, a third of you know the Heisenberg. The Heisenberg principle is very simple. It's that light, when looked at from one perspective, is a wave, and from another perspective is a particle, is a bunch of particles. So that's the form perspective, a bunch of particles. The emptiness perspective is that it's just a wave, it's just a changing wave. So that's a pretty good analogy, which I heard years ago, and I found quite helpful. So in a way, we're sitting here, each of us. I'm Tim, she's Rosemary. We all have our names. We're the embodiment of the universal. We're the embodiment of emptiness. We're the embodiment of the spirit, just as we are. So let me talk a little bit about the universal emptiness side, and then I'll talk a little bit about the form side, and then we'll do a little exercise. So in the fall, in our practice period, we have practice periods every fall where people make 8-week commitments or 7-week commitments to sit in meditation and come to one evening a week, and we study something that relates to our practice. We're going to be doing, Guy and I are going to be doing the Dhammapada together. That's a very old Buddhist text. And the Dhammapada says, presenting the emptiness perspective, the universal, absolute, experience the world as a bubble, a wave, an illusion, a dream. A bubble, an illusion, a wave, a dream. And those of you who know the Heart Sutra pretty well know that we not only say emptiness is form, form is emptiness, we then negate everything. We negate everything. All of this dreamlike material is negated. No sight, no sound, no touch, no taste, no da 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 da. Right? Some of you have memorized it. It only took me about 10 years to memorize it because it's not the easiest thing to memorize because it doesn't have a logical sequential hanger to use. But after a while, you can't help memorizing it. So what about this dreamlike existence with no eyes, no ears, no tongue, no body, no mind, no sight, no sound, no touch, no taste? What about that? Well, it comes and goes. It's here and it's gone. And I hang out with a bunch of guys who are old like me, who started practicing Zen like I did. Well, these guys have been my friends for 30 to 35 years, actually, which is older than some of you are, but nevertheless. And so we go out to breakfast together. And there's my no-eyes friend. He lost sight in one of his eyes. And then he got a cataract in his second eye. So he can't... Well, now he's had his cataract operated on, so he's a little better. But he can't drive. He couldn't do emails. He couldn't read. And then so he's the no sight guy, and I'm the no sound guy because I've ruined my hearing, not completely, but many years ago I ruined it, and it's getting worse all the time. So he's the no sight guy. I'm the no hearing guy. And then my other friend is the no-touch guy because he's got numbness from his bottom disc being out of joint. He has numbness going down his leg all the way to his foot. So there we are. There we are. Only we're having breakfast, and we can still taste. So that's why we all get together for breakfast. Taste maybe is the last one to go. Oh, I do have a friend whose taste is going too, actually, related, of course, to smell. So, gone. Everything's going away. Regardless of how old you are. And in a way, this dream comes, it presents itself, we're in it, we struggle through it. Some beautiful things, some awful things, and then it leaves. But something remains. But what is that something that remains? It's not a thing. It's not a thing. It's empty. And it's not even something that's empty. It's universal. It's big. It's huge. It's indescribable. It's not God. Okay, it's God if you want to make it God. You can get it wherever you want. It's huge. It remains. And the metaphors about emptiness, about the absolute, about the universal, the three metaphors that are usually used are most commonly used in Mahayana are what? The ocean, the metaphor of the ocean. An ocean seal samadhi. This is when your meditation gets really focused and you become really still. You have a sense of ocean seal samadhi, ocean samadhi. Other metaphor that's so commonly used is the clear sky metaphor. The sky is always clear regardless of how many clouds there are. It's still clear. I mean, it's there. It's the same sky, clouds or no clouds. So referred to sometimes as a clear sky mind in Tibetan Buddhism. And the third metaphor that's used for this thing that's not a thing, for this universal perspective, is mirror, the mirror, right? Yogacara, the mirror mind. There are many images on the mind, many on the mirror, many patterns on the mirror, many forms on the mirror, but the mirror itself is unblemished. The mirror itself just reflects everything as it is. With no gap. So those are the three metaphors. There are a bunch of other metaphors that are used, but those are the three most common ones by far. And of course, Suzuki Roshi calls all this big mind. He didn't mince words. He just said, "Oh, just big mind." But then, if people would press him, he'd say, "Oh, forget it, no mind," because as soon as you get an idea, big mind, that's not it. And our teaching in Zen is that we apprehend this through Zazen. We apprehend this spaciousness through Zazen. That's the teaching. We don't necessarily understand it. We apprehend it. If we apprehend it, whether we understand it or not, it's kind of irrelevant because it enters into us, or we enter into it, or something like that. And depending on how much meditation we do and how committed we are, we may have little flashes of it, this big perspective, or we may come to rest in it as our way of being in the world. But to rest in it in our way of being in the world, we need to do, if you believe these studies, we need to do our 10,000 hours of meditation, right? I've been talking about that. And when you count it up, you won't like it. You won't like it. You'll think, oh, I'm going to be dead by then. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. As I've said in talks I've given here before, the Beatles did 10,000 hours before they went on Ed Sullivan. Before they went on Ed Sullivan, they had put as much time into performing before groups as most groups do in their entire careers. So when they came on Ed Sullivan in 1960, whatever it was, they put in 10,000 hours, mostly in Liverpool, in pubs. But they put it in. And there's a lot of research on this. But just 100 hours, you can get a taste of this. Just 10 hours, if you really give yourself to the sitting, you can get a taste of it. So that's the universal perspective, the big mind perspective. And then let's come back to the relative perspective, to the particular, to the form. So I have a story. This story was from when I was younger. Oh, all my stories are from when I was younger. I was at a Rinzai retreat in California, and I was with two friends of mine, a couple, and they were not getting along well. And the woman was the tenzo. That means she was responsible for the food during the session, during the retreat. And the guy, his job was to come do serving. And we were studying the Dhammapada. We weren't studying it. You know, the teacher was just lecturing from the Dhammapada. Just lecturing from it. The quote I used a few minutes ago about experience the world as a bubble, an illusion, a wave, a dream. And I found out about this afterwards. Zen grapevines are interesting. I don't hear much anymore. But when I was younger, I heard lots of stuff. Nobody tells me anything. Which is okay. It's okay. I'm glad. Although, probably it was a little more fun when I heard all that stuff. So anyway, the story, well, so what I experienced was that this fellow, this Rinzai teacher, who was kind of a hard-ass Rinzai teacher, and he used the kisaku a lot, right? So one afternoon after our lunch, in which my friend was serving, and the one was in the kitchen, we were sitting, and it was really hot. Feel how humid it is, but when you sit in this kind of humidity day after day, all day, so you get drowsy, right? So I was kind of nodding, and my friend was kind of nodding too. And a teacher came down from doing Dokusan, and my friend and I were both nodding, and he went over to my friend, and he just hit him with a kisaku. Hard. And he said, all dream? Wop, 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 wop. And he did it again. He said, feel like dream? Wop, 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 wop. And then he left. Well, what I found out after the retreat was that my friend had come in maybe 5-10 minutes late to be when the Tenzo, his girlfriend, had said he should come in to do the serving. 5-10 minutes late. And she was already distraught because she was trying to organize everything and follow the rules and do it the Rinzai way. And these were Soto people, so that made it even harder for us. Just a little bit of difference stylistically. And here he comes in 5-10 minutes late. And she's pissed, right? And so what does he say to her? What does he say to her? What did he say to her? Oh, it's all a dream. And so then she runs upstairs in Doksa. Tells the teacher. That's a true story. True story. So the particular, the relative, the form, we only know the ocean through the waves. The waves are the expression of the ocean. Sometimes they're calm waves, sometimes they're steady waves, sometimes they support us, sometimes they seem very angry. Sometimes waves seem totally like they're going to... I used to surf when I was younger, body surfing. Boy, sometimes I just feel like I was going to be killed by the waves. Each of the forms, each of the forms. And so each form is a manifestation of this. Even an aunt. Even an overwrought girlfriend or boyfriend. That's an expression. That's the expression. We need to honor that expression. Even if we think, oh, that's off. That wave is off base. It shouldn't be like that. Sorry, the wave is the way it is. It's the way it is. Don't take that extra step. Just honor it because it is. So how can we honor each form, each particular expression of existence? That's our practice, Bartlett. That's our practice to do that. An overwrought spouse, the tiniest little need that our kitty cat or dog has, or the neighbor's kitty cat or dog, we identify with our kitty cat or dog, but not the neighbor's. Just to be with that, that's with some sensitivity and some openness. So as some of you know, I used to do Lakota spiritual work. And once I was at a late night Lakota, that's Sioux, it's Lakota Sioux, right? I was at a late night ceremony, late night Lakota ceremonies after the ceremony is over, they have a feast, and the person who's being helped in the ceremony puts on the feast. It's their job to put on the feast. And then before we start, we say, or we used to say, Matakiyasana, all my relatives. So we're thanking all the relatives, including the corn that's on the table, including the everything. We're thanking them, Matakiyasana, and then we eat. But the deal with these late night ceremonies is you don't know what you're going to get to eat. In the old days, they would usually have deer, but they don't have access to deer too much anymore. So sometimes they have puppy. And yes, I'm sorry, but they have puppy. And Matakiyasana. And you eat the puppy. Well, I did that. But the night that I'm talking about, I was there, and they had deer. And my friend was there, who's a vegan, but she was also really, really trying to practice this way of appreciating that your relatives are there, and then sometimes eating them as you appreciate them. And but it was hard for her to get her arms around for deer. Now, for me, for puppy, it was hard, but not for deer. Isn't it interesting how we have these cultural biases that are so deeply ingrained? So they passed the deer stew around, and I said to her, you know, this isn't puppy, this is deer. And she said, oh, thanks a lot, Tim. But there was an expectation. There is in these ceremonies, just like in so many, that you're not too spiritual to eat what they give you. What they give you, you eat it. You eat it. It's their form. It's their life. And so she ate about two bites. She didn't get nauseous, although she claimed afterwards she felt nauseous, and she stayed with the whole thing. So she honored their form. She honored their form. So another Zen teacher that I remember talking about, this was Maizumi Roshi. Maizumi Roshi had a lot of carpenters doing things. A lot of Zen people in the old days used to go into carpentry. They they'd get their graduate degrees, or they'd be halfway through their graduate degrees. Sometimes they'd be almost PhD, or they would have gotten their PhDs, and then they'd become carpenters. This is part of the culture that I come from, you guys. That's one reason when I have breakfast with all these guys, they can't see and hear and touch, because they spent their years, so many years doing carpentry. And it's hard work, you know, hard work. Anyway, carpentry. So, this fellow came up to my Zoomie, and my Zoomie said, "Well, how's the tea house going?" And the carpenter said to my Zoomie, "It's basically done, except for some of the details." And what did my Zoomie Roshi answer? "The details are all there are." Details are all there are. The details are all there are. So, some of you have read Hasidic stories, and they're much like Zen stories. How many of you read Hasidic stories before? One, two, three. Oh, quite a few of them. So, Hasidic story that I like to tell is a story. In which the teacher was asked how he decided whether his proteges were ready to become teachers, and he said, "I watched them tie their shoelaces." I watched them tie their shoelaces. So the particular, the individual, which is the manifestation of the undivided. Pretty simple, and yet we always forget it, don't we? At least I always forget it. So are we too spiritual to eat deer? Are we too spiritual to tie our shoelaces with kindness, with care, with consideration, with love? Do our shoelaces evoke love in us when you look at them? Look at them. Look at them with a still mind. See what happens. See what happens. So, to know this big mind, what does Bodhidharma say we do? He says, no dependence on words and letters, direct pointing to big mind. Also known as ocean mind, clear sky mind, mirror mind. So Bodhidharma was very terse, although probably not as terse as he is considered to be. He didn't say much, and this is this whole early Chinese Zen thing it's the pointing that's the important, pointing out this reality. Of the particular within the universal within the particular. Pointing it out. And you don't have to do that verbally. On the other hand, I come from a lineage where my teachers talk all the time. I used to listen to Suzuki Roshi an hour and a half. And I thought about Bodhidharma and some of these other teachers who would say two words. But Katagiri Roshi too. During retreat, sometime an hour and a half, an hour and 45 minutes. So what's going on here? Well, really what's going on is trying to use those words to evoke in us a big mind, or to evoke in us the ability just to be present with this. And When you listen to someone talk or you read the scriptures, sometimes you're attuned and sometimes you're not attuned. But sometimes it just takes two or three words in a 5 days of talking to all of a sudden help you come back. But still, I think there's a mean between the Rinzai way and the way Suzuki and Katagiri did it, so I'm trying to talk less than I used to. And it's not that hard. So, and there's a progressiveness to this sort of experience of touching the particular as the universal, and the universal itself as a particular. And the progression traditionally, well, there are lots of ways of talking about the progression, but today I'm going to talk about it in just a couple minutes very simply. The first component, again, this is in a context of meditation. So this is all presupposes that you're doing meditation, that you're doing zazen, presupposes that. The first one is kensho or peak experience. Peak experience is Western psychology. Kensho is Zen, right? And that's when you're just completely absorbed. When I look at you fanning yourself, I'm completely absorbed by that. I have nothing else. The fan and the roundness below the fan, I don't know what that could be, is my whole world, is everything. I need nothing more. I see the colors, I see the roundness, I see the life of it. So that's, and there's no I even, there's no comment, there's no wow, she's pregnant, or wow, she's probably tired because she's got to sit in this heat and listen to me. There's no commentary, it's just the sound itself, the sight itself, the taste itself, is everything. No gap. No gap. So that's what we call kensho, and what Abraham Maslow called peak experience. And in humanistic psychology, they've been talking about that now ever since Abraham Maslow was around, which is what, 30 years ago? Something like that. That's the first one. The second one is to crack us open beyond even our senses. No eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, to clear sky, to huge ocean, to huge boundarylessness. With no trace of separation, but no thought that I'm not separated or that I'm one. When you immediately say you're one, you're not one anymore. Right? How could you be? And that's called, that one is called Satori or enlightenment, right? Satori or enlightenment. And the third one is, first mountains are mountains and rivers are rivers, then mountains are not mountains and rivers are not rivers, then mountains are mountains and rivers are rivers. That's the third one. Come back to the form. Come back to the shoelace. It's not something you possess and you've got to get right. Oh, no, now everybody's rushing out. We're trying to tie our shoelaces right. That's not what this is about, you guys. It's very interesting how quickly we go into that mode. Oh, we are clever beings. Not something we possess, but something we honor and love just because it is. Just because it is. Regardless of how distraught our boyfriend is because we were 10 minutes late. We honor that. We honor their distraughtness. Maybe we're only 2 minutes late. That they're distraught, they're distraught. Why do we have to do anything more than just be there and support them in their distraughtness? Maybe we're only 30 seconds late. They're distraught. So, I have a friend, a couple who are friends, who I will call Tom and Sarah. And Sarah got cancer about 3 months ago. And Tom is one of my friends, is a long-term Zen practitioner with me. And so then Sarah began getting her chemotherapy, but really had bad reaction to chemotherapy, really bad reaction. And so I visited with him a couple of times, and then I emailed him once, and I said, he was talking about what a bad time she'd had with her chemotherapy. And I said, gee, you know, this has got to be really hard for you guys, and really hard for you because you're the one who has to support her. And he said, yes, it's really hard. But our moments the last 3 or 4 weeks have been the most precious moments that I can imagine. The most precious, the most wonderful, because we don't know how long she's going to be here. So we have really valued our time together in a way we forgot about for all those years. And now she's doing better since then. Now that she's doing better, I wonder if they've gotten just back into their old routine. You know, we so easily slide back into our old routines, don't we? So easily. That's why this teaching helps us live. Helps us honor each other and honor ourselves as big mind, as not different from big mind. So I want to finish by doing a guided meditation on big mind. And then we'll see if anybody wants to ask any questions or make comments after that. And this one is going to take a little while. So maybe you want to shift your posture. If you need to get up and go, maybe you should get up and go. This is going to take about 15 minutes, you guys. So, and what I've done is I've revised a guided meditation of Jack Kornfield's. I've revised it so much that I can barely read it. That's okay. Would you begin by closing your eyes and taking a few deep breaths, letting go of any stress or tension that you don't need, and just appreciating your in-breath and your out-breath. Taking all the time you need to just relax and focus on your breathing. And when you're ready, you might want to contemplate the cycles of birth and death, seeing in your mind's eye how everything is born and everything dies, everything dies and everything is born. And you might want to picture the circumstances of your current life as offering you a perfect chance to learn important and universal lessons. And when you're ready, sincerely ask yourself what these lessons might be. And when you're ready, you might want to extend this big mind perspective to a person close to you, a loved one, a close friend. As you're sitting quietly, you might want to picture this person and then feel how you ordinarily relate to him or her. And whenever you're ready, you might take a step back in your mind to consider the roles and identities that person inhabits. Male or female, son or daughter, partner, friend, student, teacher, artist, athlete, employee, boss, successes, failures, ups, downs, And when you're ready, you might want to step back further and contemplate the unfolding of that person's karma. See how they were born into a certain family. Picture them as an infant, a child, a teenager, an adult, an old person. Who are they really underneath all the clay of their roles and life stages? What is their essence, their timeless spirit? What are they given an opportunity to learn? And what is it like to relate to them outside of their roles, outside of time? Whenever you're ready to move on, taking as much time as you want, you might ask yourself how you can bring a big mind perspective, how you can tap into this big mind perspective and bring a wise and heartfelt response to the difficulties that arise in your friend's life, in your life, in whatever situation you might find yourself. And in the next 2 or 3 minutes, taking all the time you need, begin to come back to the room, knowing that you can access or tap in to this big mind anytime you need to. Back to the room, open your eyes. And I'll see if you have any comments or questions. And those of you who still have your eyes closed, you might find that in the next minute or two, your eyes are just opening on their own. Who knows? It might be possible. We never know. Okay, everybody. Coming back to the room alert, with full energy, and feeling so much better than before. Questions, comments about my talk or about the guided meditation?
They're usually happy terms and positive terms.
Yeah, so her question is, when they talk in the literature about the emptiness, they always talk about it positively. And then is there a way to experience that isn't positive? That's your question, yeah. And yes, definitely. But that's not full emptiness. Full emptiness is only all-embracing. But you can experience existential emptiness, great doubt, emptiness at any point in this process. And sometimes the more you go into emptiness, the more you meditate, the more you'll go into a dark night of the soul, where it's a Kierkegaardian emptiness. But that's just that's just the way it goes. But the literature doesn't talk much about that. The literature doesn't talk about that. But the Zen teachers do, especially in Rinzai. They're always talking about the doubt and how what to do when the doubt that comes up. Now, I asked Koji-san about that once. He said, well, we don't talk about it because we don't want you to get some idea in your head about it. It doesn't mean we don't experience it. A sincere student doesn't experience it. Pardon?
In one of his talks, he referred to your life may seem like a mountain
yes.
or an abyss.
Yes.
It seems like
yes.
the dark side.
Yes, 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 yes. Uh-huh, uh-huh, uh-huh. So, yep. So, but if that happens in your meditation, it's a good sign. You know, come hang out with me. It's a good sign. It means that you're really getting into it, into this root problem of self and other, of life and death. It's a good sign. And how to differentiate that from systemic and ongoing depression is a whole other issue. But this is not systemic and ongoing depression. Systemic and ongoing depression needs to be medicated because you need to get your biochemistry in enough sort of equilibrium that you can do this work. But you can still do it. You just need to get your body, your physiologically in equilibrium. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yes, so I often thought these existentialists, geez, I wish Camus had met Suzuki Roshi, really. Really? I'm not kidding. But would he have been taken with him enough to do this? I don't know. Yeah.
There is this quote from Camus, which I can't quite remember, but it's something like, in the deepest of winter, I discovered in myself eternal summer.
Yeah, and Heidegger is very much like that. Yeah. Heidegger. Yeah. But then there's Sartre, God. Well, we don't need to get into this, right? Yeah.
Earlier you mentioned about the duality of what might mean a wave and a particle.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to share something else about that.
Okay.
Which I think is amazing. But the same thing is true for matter. Matter is also a wave and a particle. Electrons and and molecules. And even you and I, we just have a very, very short wavelength, but we also true for matter.
Well, that's wonderful to hear that. Wonderful. Is that being taught regularly in school now?
In college physics. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Good. Anything else? Yeah. Hi. Good to see you.
You too. I just wanted to add something to your exposition about Camus and Star.
Okay.
I also have a name of Samuel. I like Samuel Beckett.
Pardon?
I like the works of Samuel Beckett when I was reading in that period anyway. I think he really deals with a lot of that kind of sort of black and more so.
Well, Camus was quite poetic, don't you think?
Camus was poetic. Beckett is poetic too, but I think he doesn't really posit any meaning out of that.
Yeah.
Just kind of black emptiness.
Yeah.
But I was going to say that the idea of the great doubt, I think, is a very useful kind of process, because it's kind of a doubt of the way we normally look at things. You know,
that's right.
We normally think about things.
Yeah.
The way the world is, so it's
yeah.
Very useful kind of
yeah. Thank you. Anything else?
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
Jeff.
So my father's been having medical problems lately. He's 93. And he just got moved into an assisted living center. He was living independently. I went to visit him this past week because we were expecting he was going to have back surgery because he fell a while back and it turned out he fractured a vertebra again. And then on further evaluation, it turned out it wasn't recommended because his pain had kind of gone away, and that was the only reason for the procedure. So I went there with the plan of driving out on Wednesday, taking him to see the doctor on Thursday, and then coming back on Friday. Pretty short visit, 6-hour drive. And I wanted to get back on Saturday because I've got classes, which I really love. So we went through the process with the surgeon, decided not to do the procedure. And then the next day, and we're still going to go back, and I stopped off to visit him for a while. And he was shaving, or rather, he was getting ready to shave. So he had parked his wheelchair by the sink in the room, and he was lathering up his face. And one of the medical attendants came in with his medication, and I said, well, my dad is shaving. It's taking a long time. And she said, well, it'll take as long as it takes. She left, and he was still lathering his face. And then eventually he picked up the razor, and he shaved, and he reshaved, and he reshaved. And it probably took him 20 minutes to shave. So when he was finished with that and had taken his medications, he got in his wheelchair and we went outside, rolled around for a bit, and then we parked under an awning. He gets pretty easily confused. And so we just sat for probably 20 minutes. And then I came home as planned. So I hope to have other opportunities to visit him in the coming weeks. But you never know.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.